This is TalkBack, 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309.
This is News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. KGVO, Missoula's news and weather station.
Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome. It is the Tuesday, March 31st edition of TalkBack. TalkBack this morning is brought to you by our friends at Y West Storage. Secure, flexible self-storage in Missoula. Give Y West a call at 406-510-0590 to reserve your unit today. And these are all 406 numbers. Quality Seamless Gutters of Montana brings you expert gutter installation and repair. Give them a call at Quality Seamless Gutters, 728-4002. Get a free quote. Bruckner's Truck and Equipment, heavy duty truck sales, parts and service. Call Bruckner's at 541-9097. Busy Bees Cleaning Service, commercial cleaning you can trust. Call 550-3219 and get a free estimate from Busy Bees. Pivots Plus, Montana's leader in irrigation parts service and sales. Give Pivots Plus a call at 683-4418. Gomer's Diesel Incorporated, diesel repair parts and service in Missoula. Call 728-7620 for Gomer's. And at Harrington Surgical Supply, they provide medical and surgical supplies to healthcare professionals all across western Montana. The number for Harrington is 721-8468.
The views and opinions expressed on TalkBack are not those of the staff, management, or advertisers.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you along this morning. I am Peter Christian. That is Mr. Nick Christensen over there. Hey, Mr. Nick.
Good morning.
All right. And we have two of our favorite guests joining us here in the studio this morning. We have Sandy Perrin, the plant clinic coordinator for Missoula County, and Dr. Peter Kolb, forestry specialist with MSU Extension Forestry. Lady and gentlemen, welcome. Good to see you guys again.
Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
How are you?
Great.
All right. So the floor is yours. And so, by the way, one of the reasons that you guys are so popular is people love to ask you questions. And the phone lines are going to be open all the way till 10 o'clock this morning. If you have a question about maybe that, we were just talking about that big snowstorm we got a while back and some of the damage that it did, you might want to compare notes with Dr. Kolb or just whatever might be going on in your yard or garden. That's why they are here this morning at 721-1290. So ladies first, what is going on in your department right now at the plant clinic?
Well, a lot of questions about soil testing, of course, getting your gardens ready for the season, what went wrong last year, what can do better this year. Also, it's a great time, of course, pruning, doing a dormant spray. We've been working hard in our gardens at work, trying to get things in that shape ship for that.
So now when it comes to gardening, I mean, are we a little early yet to start gardening or what?
You know, soil temperatures are kind of in the mid-40s, so we can start planting the cold season things like lettuce, spinach, radishes, but you know, we've always have that possibility. Who knows? We could get another 8 to 10 inches of snow, another cold,
tomorrow.
Wet snap.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not, you know, yes, you can get started, but just knowing that Mother Nature's in charge and it could throw us a curve. So don't get overly excited. I see people wanting to plant peas and, you know, keep on some of these things that will rot a little bit easier. So we have a plan B as a backup to cover it up in some manner if you are planting outside.
Okay. Dr. Kolb.
Well, and you mentioned we're in drought. What are we going to do about it? Actually, in western Montana, we're not in drought
Great.
At all.
That's good.
And I just planted a tree the other weekend, and the soil is so wet and water saturated, I almost held off because roots need oxygen. And, you know, when you're digging a hole and you're packing soil back in, when it's really wet, it'll turn into mud, and that doesn't create a good planting medium for root growth. And the other thing to add to Sandy, you know, plants react to sun's energy too. And we're still about 25% less sun energy than we will have in June. And so your plants might start, and certainly, you know, like my daffodils and crocuses are up and growing. But for most of the sun-loving garden plants, there's not enough sun energy out there yet to really get them to grow super well. And that's part of it. It's not just temperature. It's how much solar radiation is fueling that photosynthesis in those plants.
Well, with that, we're up against our first break already. And the phone lines are open if you have a question for Dr. Kolb or Sandy Perrin. That's why they are here to answer your questions this morning at 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309. We would love to have you give us a call. We'll be right back after this.
Dennis Bragg with your updated weather. A chance of mixed rain and snow showers again on Tuesday, but just a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. After that, look for some sun breaks with a high near 53 degrees and calm winds. Then on Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 32 and again, light calm winds. For Wednesday, clouds will hang around with a 40% chance of rain, mainly afternoon. Highs just below 60 degrees. And on Thursday, looks like we'll be back to some rain showers across west central Montana.
We all have someone we love, like the favorite lyric in our favorite song. You can't imagine life without them. So tell them today, I love you. Get screened. It could help save their life. Visit cancer.org/get screened to learn more.
Being a family caregiver can be rewarding, but it can also be expensive. Search caregiver compensation programs at the AARP Foundation Paid for Care Hub, developed with support from United Healthcare. Visit paidforcare.aarpfoundation.org.
We are back on TalkBack. 721-1290 is our number. Our special guest, Dr. Peter Kolb and Sandy Perrin. And the reason they're here is to answer your questions. We already have callers getting in the queue. And I believe Diane is first. Diane, good morning. You're on with Dr. Kolb and Sandy. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to mention that I live on what I call the rock, on the hill in Lolo. And our soil is super, super thin. We bought the place new a long time ago and didn't know what we were doing, but we have managed to keep grass growing all this time. However, I've noticed in the last 2 or 3 years or so, we have this nice plush underlayment of moss growing in there. And I personally don't mind it, although I would like to know what's going on and what's causing that. So our grass is thin and the moss is just getting more luxuriant. So I would love some input on that.
Sandy.
Also, soil compaction can lead to moss, but if you don't have much soil and there's a rock underlay, so that's you have drainage issues, obviously. So that's where moss starts to flourish is, you know, where there's a lot of standing water in the soil. Sometimes it's shade, but soil compaction. And typically, a lot of times in winters, because especially this winter, it was wet, but we didn't have a lot of snow cover. But still, so there's a lot of moisture hanging around, and that's where moss flourishes. A lot of times as the season dries out, my moss tends to go away without ever treating it.
Oh, okay. So if I want it gone, do I just need to have it aerated or?
Aeration is great. Also, there are some iron sulfate products that help take care of the moss and kill it. Then you have to rake it out. So a lot of those. And fertilization of your lawn, so making your grass more competitive.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. I know my husband really doesn't like it. And so, yeah, we just needed to know how to address this issue. Thank you so much.
You bet.
All right. Thanks for the call. And Nancy is standing by. Nancy, good morning. You're on with Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin. Go ahead.
Yeah, morning, Glory. And I just want to know, everything in my yard is flourishing. I live in Musselshell County, and the soil here is terrible, and so is our water, the well water. And I just usually plant hardy perennials, and like my potatoes, I just put in pots. But I noticed that my chives and my onions and my daisies and my irises and my tiger lilies are absolutely flourishing. They're going to really be a bumper crop, I think, this year. Beautiful. But I noticed my rhubarb is not coming up yet, and I've got three plants. And I know rhubarb is a very, very sensitive and a touchy plant to contend with. And I'd like to know, maybe you just answered the question, the sunlight, it's not getting enough sunlight. And also, when's the best time to transplant or to separate rhubarb plants? Thank you so much, and Easter blessings to you both.
Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Sandy, please.
Well, the time to separate them is typically right now, really early, before they start to show much growth. And it is probably maybe a little early. Mine's just barely showing any color. It's not really, you know, it's just the early color coming out of the ground. So it certainly could be a little earlier in your neighborhood that it would not be up yet.
Okay. Well, thanks. She has hung up. So thanks for the call. And by the way, the phone lines are open. If you have a question for Dr. Kolb or Sandy, that's why they're here, is to answer your questions this morning at 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309. This has been an interesting winter. I don't want to call it a non-winter, but we haven't had really, really huge cold snaps, and we haven't had, except for the big dump we had a couple weeks ago, not a whole lot of snow, at least in the Missoula Valley.
Right. Well, it's been very mild temperatures, so rather than snow, we got a lot of rain.
Right.
And that's why when you look at the NRCS snowpacks and moisture indices and things like that, here in western Montana, we're somewhere between 90 and 110% of normal.
That's great.
So we got a lot of moisture, and that's why our soils are so saturated right now. And the downside of that, water in the soil is a lubricant, so the soil doesn't have much strength to it. And that's why trees come over a lot easier. Their roots just don't hold in that. And so the most significant snow we got, for example, north of Missoula, Everett, where I live, is 2 weekends ago. We got 16 inches of heavy, heavy, heavy wet snow in 24 hours. And that for us, I mean, that's like a 50-year record to have that. And so spring snow is pretty hard on trees, especially a mild winter like this, because I would estimate we're 2 to 3 weeks ahead of schedule, or what would be considered normal for western Montana. So the sap is rising in the trees, the buds are swelling, and trees, when the sap rises, are going to weigh 2 to 3 times more than they do in August. So our crowns are very, very heavy.
Now, you've been to my house many times. You climbed both of my trees, in fact, and my maple trees. And when I went out and initially saw the heavy, heavy snow, I just took a broom and just kind of smacked the limbs a little bit. The limbs a little bit. And the snow came off, and those limbs just went, whoop. It was almost like there was a sigh of relief. Like, thank you very much, human, for doing that, because we couldn't do it on our own.
Right. Well, a lot of trees got bent over or broken off, or the roots, they got uprooted with all the leverage on there. And certainly on our 20 acres, we lost about 100 trees that are between 4 and 20 inches in diameter. So it looks like a hurricane hit our place from that heavy wet. And like I said, we got 16 inches, and the tops were already very wet. So you did exactly the right thing, Peter. So especially in the spring, trees are very susceptible to heavy snow accumulations, and they bend over. So going out there, push broom is perfect. I just put against the stem and give it a shake, so I don't get the snow dumped on me. But if your tree, especially your younger trees, up to 20 feet, if they get bent over by the snow and the snow has come off and they haven't straightened up, you can actually physically straighten them. You're going to have to stake them. I actually did that with a 30-foot-tall tree next to my house that my wife really liked. I was going to cut it down because it was bent over horizontal. But I put a loose knot with a quick-release knot on it at about 2 inches on the top, so about 25 feet up. And I pulled this tree straight, and I have it tied down. And you got to leave that tree tied down like that for at least the summer, usually about a year, not more than that. And then those wood cells that have been damaged by that bending will, what we call, lignify. They'll build scar tissue, and the tree will stand straight. And I've done that for years and years, and it works really well. For little trees, you can just get a wooden pole or push broom and prop it up so it's straight. And it doesn't take very long. Like I said, 3 months, leave that on there, and then the tree, you can save the tree. If you don't, they won't naturally straighten up because, they have so much weight in their tops already that they won't straighten up.
With that, we're up against a break, and the phone lines are jammed right now for Dr. Kolb and Sandy, so we're going to get to those in just a moment. Our number is 721-1290. We're coming right back after this.
When it comes to ag...
This is the captain. I want to invite you to join us every Friday morning from our local fishing program, Catching the Big Ones, live on the banks of brooks at Paradise Falls. We'll help you get ready for a weekend of fishing with area reports and advice, and try to make you a winner with our weekly trivia. Catching the Big Ones every Friday morning, 8 to 9, live from Paradise Falls on News Talk, KGVO AM 1290 and FM 98.3.
And everybody wants to talk with Dr. Kolb and Sandy Parent, so let's jump right in. Paul has been waiting the longest. Paul, thanks for holding. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I wanted to talk about Smurfit Stone. And later this week, on the 2nd, they're having a town's meeting. And I just wanted to talk about Smurfit Stone. There's a couple spots there in Smurfit Stone where there's a settling ponds and stuff. And I wanted to propose a micromediation plan to put micromediation around the ponds to stop the toxins from coming through. And we have a local guy. His name is Glenn Bamcock. And he's done this mushroom micromediation, like a filter to stop the toxins and stuff. And he just lost funding. So I just wanted to bring that to the radio.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Dr. Kolb, Sandy, please.
Well, what you're talking, the toxins you're talking about is dioxin. Okay, and that was a byproduct of the bleaching process. When you bleach a wood fiber, I mean, you got to separate the lignin from the cellulose, and the cellulose is what the white paper is out of the. And in that process, a side product is a form of dioxin. And dioxin was the carcinogen in Agent Orange, things like that. Now, the amounts of dioxin in the settling ponds out at Frenchtown are controversial. Okay, I've seen lots of reports of it, and there's really, really very, very, very small amounts in there. There's some areas where there might be higher concentrations. I've never really gotten a full report to see what's on there. There's a lot of hype about it, and not that it's not warranted, because dioxin is nasty stuff. The problem with things like micro-remediation is that unless something breaks down that dioxin, and dioxin is a very resistant chemical, you know, you're just going to move it from one place to another. I mean, so if it gets absorbed in plants, the way that micro-remediation works is then you remove the plants off the site, and that's how you get rid of it. So I'm not up to speed on the mushroom, the fungal portion of it. Now, fungi are known to absorb a lot of heavy metals and things like that. But unless you remove those fungal fruiting bodies from the site, those materials stay there. Our caller probably knows more about that situation than I actually do. I've, you know, read all the reports many years ago when Smurfit Stone was up and running, and I've read a lot of stuff since. And I haven't gotten a clear picture of what's actually going on out there. Unless there is a process to remove that material from the site, microbes, things like that, won't necessarily, they'll move it around, they'll accumulate them in their tissue, but then they die and they decompose, and that material once again ends up in the soil. So it's a little more complicated than a lot of people think it might be. Sandy?
Does that help you, sir?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay,
am I still on the phone?
Yeah, you're still on.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, I know it was going to go through the mushroom and be, you know, have a cap, and we could remove that and get rid of it like that. So it'd just be a small step to help the soil there in Frenchtown at the mill.
Absolutely. I mean, if you don't do anything, those things will just stay there. And so, you know, it's a great idea to start tackling it a little at a time. I mean, it's nowhere close to the Berkeley Pit in Butte. But, you know, it's going to take a couple hundred years for the Berkeley Pit to get remediated. But if you don't start somewhere, it isn't ever going to happen. And, you know, it's a beautiful wetland site out there. It'd be nice to turn that into a waterfowl sanctuary or something like that. But
what I was thinking. Yes, I was thinking the same thing, that a little sanctuary for plants and animals to recover.
But, you know, another thing, you could plant willows, cottonwoods out there, and at some point remove the wood, because those woody species also absorb some of that material, and that's another way to get it off-site.
Yeah, I think it would be cheaper to do that, and it would save the taxpayers a lot of money.
Right.
In Frenchtown.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We're going to go ahead and take our break now because there's so many folks waiting. We'll get this break out of the way and take all those calls. We'll be right back. Again, our guests here in the studio, Dr. Peter Kolb and Sandy Perrin, will be back right after this.
Attention, Dennis Bragg with your updated weather. A chance of mixed rain and snow showers again on Tuesday, but just a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. After that, look for some sun breaks with a high near 53 degrees and calm winds. Then on Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 32 and again, light calm winds. For Wednesday, clouds will hang around with a 40% chance of rain, mainly afternoon. Highs just below 60 degrees. And on Thursday, looks like we'll be back to some rain showers across west central Montana.
We have all sorts of fascinating conversations during the break, but we want to put our callers first, so let's get Glenn up next. Glenn, good morning. You are on TalkBack.
I didn't want to mention it until I asked you.
Glenn, good morning. You're on TalkBack, sir. Hello, Glenn.
Hello.
Glenn, you're on TalkBack. Go ahead, sir.
I'm here. I appreciate this. My question is, I've got five dogs at our property, and with all this moisture, and they run and chase a ball. The lawn is just lumpy. Is there a good way to kind of flatten it out? Maybe like one of those big asphalt rollers or something to flatten it out, maybe aerate it after. What's the best bet?
I would probably aerate the soil, and then also you could use what's called like a power rake that thatches, and that will help decrease those bumps. And you may need to do some reseeding and fertilization afterwards. And
so a big roller wouldn't be a good thing?
No, that would just compact the soil even more, and which is not a good idea. Yeah, so but you're going to have to keep the dogs off once you do, or at least a portion of it, once you do all that remediation so it doesn't get trampled down again.
I gotcha. Okay, I will give it a shot. Thanks.
Thank you for the call, sir. All right, I believe Rick is standing by. Rick, good morning. You're on TalkBack. Thanks for holding.
I have like 40 odd roses, and I took the leaves off by hand because they wouldn't defoliate themselves. Is that a good way, or could I have used a liquid on them? I know there's a liquid out there that'll make the leaves fall off. They seem to be doing better than they've ever done before right now, and I don't know if that's due to the weather. The only one that the leaves didn't fall, or the only one the leaves fell off naturally, was I've got a 35-year-old shrub rose. It only blooms once a year, and I was wondering how long will that shrub rose live, and does the defoliation, I think that's the name of the word, of the leaves, how does that affect if you use the spray compared to pulling it off by hand?
Well, I'm not really aware of the spray. Are you, Peter? No. Pulling them off by hand is kind of the standard practice, or a lot of times Mother Nature just takes care of it as a new growth comes out. Sometimes it just pushes that old leaf off, the abscission layer finally takes effect. But it's, you know, I mean, if the rose bush is really full and dense, you probably want to get some of that foliage out of there so you don't have disease problems later on if you have overhead irrigation, or we get a real wet period, or if they're susceptible to black spot or powdery mildew. But other than that, mostly I just pruned them and let Mother Nature take its course.
Yeah, and when spring hits, you know, and the tree the rose becomes physiologically active, it'll naturally drop those leaves. But I also have domestic roses, and the leaves will stay green and all winter long if they get frozen too hard. And there's nothing wrong with leaving the green leaves on. I mean, they're functional. Yeah. So I'm assuming you're talking about the dead, dried out leaves.
Half my roses, the greenery, they were supple when I pulled them off. I don't think we had a cold enough weather for them to go really into a dormant state like they normally would. But I have another question. I have a Canadian rose for zone 4, and a couple of stems are 3/4 of the way to the top are fairly black. But at the top, I've got a lot of greenery and a lot of leaves coming out. Should I get rid of those stems, or should I just... Should I leave them?
I'd take them out because there must be some damage if they're black. It just hasn't made its way to the top yet.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you.
You know, your question of shrub roses. I mean, we have shrub roses that we planted 30 years ago. And, you know, you just got to prune the dead out, the dead canes, and sometimes the senescent canes. And, you know, the newer canes will flower better. But other than that, I mean, they live a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do prune this one back occasionally. It's a once a year blooming, and it'll bloom for almost a month, and it's super spectacular yellow. It's on the border of my property and the neighbor just lets me take care of all the roses that are on our property line. He doesn't want anything to do with them. But that rose, I've cut it completely down to the ground at one time, and now it's back up to about 14 feet tall. And they're pretty hard. They're a pretty hardy plant. I think roses are hardy. People don't realize that they're as strong as they are. But thank you for your answers.
Thank you for the call, sir. We appreciate it. Ward is standing by. Ward, good morning.
Hi, what's your call?
Good morning, Ward. You're on. Go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. Hey, we had that big wind down here in December in the lower Bitterroot. I was just wondering if Dr. Cole knew if the Forest Service was organizing any salvage sales, because some of the areas were badly damaged. So huge amounts of trees knocked down by that wind. And I'll listen on our radio when you answer. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, sir.
Well, I personally don't know if they are or not. I would hope that they're addressing that. And, you know, you're not the only place. There's a lot of places where the forest just got hammered by that windstorm. The windstorm bent a lot of trees. It didn't necessarily break them off, but then that wet, heavy snow we got did the coup de grace on it. And the concern of mine is, and I've mentioned this quite a bit, is those downed trees are now primary brood trees for bark beetles. So Douglas fir beetle, western pine beetle, mountain pine beetle, pine engraver beetle will breed in those. And, you know, two beetles will on average have 80 offspring, and it depends on which one. So within 3 to 4 generations, two beetles can produce 500,000 offspring. And so the danger, my big concern is that this fall or next year, we're going to have a massive bark beetle outbreak, because when all those young beetles, those broods come out, they're going to then be hungry, and they don't fly super far, or maybe a mile or two, depending which way the wind is blowing. And they're going to be mass attacking the remaining healthy trees. So if we don't get that stuff cleaned up, and I'm in the same boat. I mean, I had about 100 Douglas fir trees come down on my property, and I've been working my butt off to get that at least cut up and stacked so the stems dry out so that there's no successful beetle broods in there. But the problem is the whole mountainside is now covered with these damaged trees. And so my big concern is, in a year or two, we're going to see orange trees all across the landscape if these blown-over trees are not dealt with. Now, that said, unless it's some kind of an emergency order, it takes the Forest Service, because of the regulations they have to follow. And, you know, politics aside, the Trump administration has shortcutted a lot of those processes. Again, there's pros and cons to all of that, but that will potentially allow the Forest Service to react more quickly to these types of events as a preventative measure, and certainly our mills need the wood. The problem is, in the Bitterroot, a lot of trees that came over are ponderosa pine, and there's no market for ponderosa pine. So the best you can do is, it's not the greatest firewood, but it does work as firewood. I mean, I burn it in my house when it's not super cold. But cut them into short lengths and stack them where the sun will dry them out. And that will make them less susceptible to bark beetles. And
so it's the moisture is the breeding ground, right?
Well, the new, fresh, wet wood. And so as it dries out, so the beetles are going to lay their eggs in there. The larvae are going to hatch, and depending on the beetle species, I mean, Douglas fir, it takes them a year to do a cycle. So they're the easiest ones to deal with, because you got a whole year to kill that brood. Ponderosa pine is a little tougher. Mountain pine beetle, western pine beetle, it's more like 2 months, and those larvae will mature. So by getting that wood to dry out, then the larvae run out of moisture, but also cutting short lengths. There was a really interesting study done in the Black Hills that to complete their life cycle, the beetles need a high nitrogen source. And that's usually the fungi that invade the wood, gather that or collect the nitrogen. And then when the fungi produce fruiting bodies, those spores, the immature beetles will feed on that and gives them the nitrogen to complete producing their exoskeleton. And by cutting short, there's not enough nitrogen in that wood for the fungi to collect it. And so the beetle larvae may stay alive. You may end up with what are called callow adults. They're not fully mature, but their maturation process is short-circuited when they can't get that fungi-rich nitrogen source. Now, that was a Black Hills study, you know, things vary regionally. So the best thing is just cut it short, stack it high so it's well aerated, let the sun dry it out. Weather predictions are we're going to have a fairly hot, dry summer. So that's the good thing. The bad thing is with all that wood down, we're going to have fire fuel from Hades out across that landscapes. And that's a big concern.
We're going to take a break. Come right back. We have Jeff and Art both standing by waiting to visit with Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin. And I have several phone lines open. If you have a question or comment about your yard or garden, they'll be here with us till 10 o'clock at 721-1290. We'll be right back after this.
Worried about with KGRZ Sports, here's your sports update. Brought to you by Campbell Kia of Missoula. New and pre-owned vehicles at a no-pressure buying experience. Located off Expressway and online at CampbellKia.com. Here's a sour one.
Grizzlies basketball star Money Williams has officially announced he has entered the transfer portal. Via Instagram, he said, "I want to thank Grizz Nation for all the love and support they've given me from day one. It will never be forgotten. Grizz Nation will always hold a special place in my heart. That said, I have decided to enter my name into the transfer portal to explore my options." Money played 3 seasons with the Grizzlies, 81 games, and he racked up over 1,300 points, including almost 700 this last season, one of the highest scoring single seasons in Grizz men's basketball history. A pair of Grizzly softball players were honored by the Big Sky Conference this week. Grace Lopez was named Big Sky Player of the Week, the first for a Grizzly since 2024. Kara Sweet was the Pitcher of the Week. That's a look at sports. I'm Ace Sowerwell.
Listen, retirement is the long game. We can't play about our future or our finances. Let's put ourselves in the right position.
Start building your retirement plan at thisisretirement.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The more you listen to your kids, the closer you'll be. Find resources to help you support your kids and their emotional well-being at soundedouttogether.org. That's soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Pivotal.
Hey, we're back on Talk Back. 721-1290 is our number. We're learning a lot with Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin. And Jeff has been waiting the longest. So, Jeff, good morning, and thanks for holding.
Hey, good morning, all. A couple of questions. First of all, on lilacs, I took your advice several years ago, got cold, and had one that was really kind of spindly and scraggly because of frost kill, and I cut it all back, and it's doing really well. But it's got a lot of branches coming out now, maybe as many as 80 to 100 at the bottom. Maybe that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but a lot. And I'm just wondering, should I just let it grow like that, or is it okay to start pruning it back, or should I? Or Danny, what do you recommend on that as well?
Well, I'm assuming you're meaning it must be a common lilac. They do grow pretty dense like that. And, you know, if you'd like a thinner look, certainly you can get in there and prune, because it can cause problems. They do get some bacterial blights and such like that, that if it's, again, if the weather is conducive to that wet, rainy period in the spring. But either way, it can go. You know, I would recommend doing it maybe after the blooms so you don't sacrifice all of this year's blooms to start pruning some out. But
yeah, lilacs are very forgiving. I mean, so you have a clonal response. You cut the top off and the roots suckered like crazy. That's what they do. So, I mean, and I have lilacs, and I just let my clone get bigger. At some point, I'm going to dig some of those up and transplant them somewhere else. But you can, like Sandy said, if you thin them, then more energy will go to individual stems. They'll get taller. They'll be more robust. If you don't, then you're going to end up with this kind of bread loaf type of clonal lilac growth. And, you know, again, it's what you want. I mean, you can do a lot with lilacs. You can prune them back. They're going to keep suckering. So when you remove a shade and soil temperature is what really stimulates suckering on them. So if you thin them too much, then you're going to get a lot of suckering as a response to that. So you want to keep the ground shaded around them and reduce the stems to the point where it's still is shaded, but then the stems you leave are growing big enough to shade that site.
Okay. I'm for as little work as possible. So I think given my place in life right now, it's good just to kind of let them go and be what they're going to be. I also started taking off the seed pods from last year. And should I do that? Is there any advantage to doing that? And can you, one, propagate lilacs from those seeds, or is that pretty much a useless thing and just do cut up, divide and replant?
Yeah, I mean, mine do reseed. Certainly, they're the common types, so they will, do some reseeding from that. As far as, pruning out the dead seed heads, I think it's more aesthetics than it really is beneficial. It looks a lot nicer. But other than that, I don't think it really makes a difference as far as the bloom potential for next year.
Okay, and can you propagate those from seeds fairly easily, or is that a kind of...
I don't know. They grow up my house pretty darn easily in the rock and the dirt. Yeah, so I would, yes, they propagate very easily.
Yeah, and again, the seeds need what's called a stratification period. I mean, so if they've been on there all winter long, they've gotten their cold freezing necessity. They might need some cool damp. So if you collect those seeds, usually it's best to try and propagate them maybe in containers where you can control the moisture, where it's cool and damp, and then once they come up, then you can transplant them. But a lot of seeds, they do need a cold, they need a freezing period, they need a cool, damp period for the seed coat to break down enough for the seed inside to actually be able to germinate and grow.
Okay, well, I was, again, trying to think of the easy way, just taking the seed pods and letting them roll up along like a property line to make, maybe try to start a hedge with them if they will propagate by themselves.
Well, if they get baked by the sun and it's hot and dry, they probably won't. So, again, they kind of, seedlings are pretty sensitive. They need a kind of a cool, damp period for the seed to germinate.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Art is standing by. Art, good morning. You're on with Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I've got a question for Sandy. My garlic is already about 10 or 12 inches high. Is there anything I should be concerned about? I mean, that's awfully early. It started coming up a couple weeks ago already. And what should I be thinking?
Wow, they must be in a pretty warm location to be up that high. Most garlic I've seen is like maybe 2 to 3 inches. So if there's any, if there's nights are going to get probably below 25, you may think that you may want to put a remake cloth over them, things like that. Or, if it's down at lower than that, but keep your fingers crossed that we don't go too much lower than that at this point.
Okay, well, that's what I was wondering, about the freezing temperatures. It's been cold here. I'm up in Linda Vista, so, I mean, I'm not in the valley floor or anything, kind of southwest facing. But, they're coming right along.
All right, thank you. Thank you for the call, sir. We appreciate it. We have
thank you.
Emma, Joe, and Lisa are all waiting to visit with you. We're going to take a quick break. And again, our guests here in the studio, Dr. Peter Kolb, forestry specialist with MSU Extension Forestry. Sandra Perrin is plant clinic coordinator for Missoula County. We're going to come right back after this.
Our Senator Steve.
We are back on Talk Back. Lots of phone calls, lots of folks waiting. Emmett has been waiting the longest. Emmett, good morning. You're on Talk Back. Thanks for holding.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Well, as I've mentioned before, because I've talked about my garden, I've had a few questions over the years. I have a small community garden we have, in the back courtyard. It's really nice. Except, like I mentioned, that we had this big bush of spearmint someone had planted and moved away years ago, which was taking up a lot of the nutrients. Thankfully, someone finally got that removed a couple of years ago. Finally. So we don't have all that, nutrient mostly what we've had to do is have just potted plants. People just plant nice flowers and potted plants and a few other type of things. And I've just been enjoying that. And, of course, my perennial of daisies and another small part of that section. But now that that plant, that big bush, that big spearmint bush has finally been removed, I realized also, because I was thinking about this, is it okay if I could just plant some of my regular garden seeds, like cosmos or regular assorted flowers? Because I got a couple of packets in the grocery store. It'd be really nice if I could start doing this again. But would I need some sort of fertilizer or something like this? Because I'm thinking without that big spearmint bush, probably the nutrients are going to come back. That big spearmint bush isn't soaking up all the nutrients from all the other plants that would need it. So I just kind of would like kind of your advice, you know, whether I can go and plant in the spring this year or just have some more potted plants this year. You know, it might take a while, or if I need fertilizer or what.
Oh, Sandy, it's all yours.
Yeah, certainly. You know, generally every year when you're growing annual plants, you're going to have to add some type of fertilizer, maybe also a good dose of compost if they provide that. A lot of times community gardens give you the compost, but certainly fertilizer to grow annual plants is going to be needed. The nitrogen component is always the one that helps plants grow fast.
All right. I was just hoping that we'd had the nutrients back. I was hoping it hadn't been sucked up, but it probably was. So probably need some compost or some other thing, or at least some, you know, a plant miracle plant grow. I wonder if that miracle plant food is any good. I tried a little bit, and I don't have any. It didn't help a few years ago, or if I should just get some regular. I don't have a big garden. I don't need a huge bag of compost, you know.
Yeah, it's going to need something. You know, most fertilizers, the plant doesn't care what brand it is as long as it's available to the plant. So whether it's Miracle-Gro or compost, tea or fish fertilizer, they don't care as long as it's, they make it into a soluble form for the plant to absorb.
Yeah, feed me.
Yeah, they wouldn't look at labels. And they don't watch commercials. I wanted a little humor. All right, well, thank you. I got a strange humor, surreal humor. All right, well, thanks.
Evan, thanks for the call. Joe, standing by. Joe, good morning. You're on with Sandy and Dr. Cole. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yeah, you covered the beetle situation pretty well there. One variable that I don't know if you talked about, I might have missed, is the lack of hard freezing temperatures, which could... I believe that helps control the numbers of beetles. And then if you have any comments about your, you know, you've done quite a bit of climate change research, and I really appreciate all your commentary on that subject. So if you have any updates, because I know that, you know, the climate change debate is still raging, and no kings.
Okay, thanks for the call. Dr. Cole.
Can I listen on the radio, please?
Sure.
Well, with regard to cold temperatures, we really don't have a lot of beetle larvae kill until we reach 30, 40 below zero, okay? But it's timing. So if we get 30 below zero, because, you know, we had a high pressure that split the Arctic circulation in half. So the predictions for are supposed to be a hotter, drier summer for Montana based on those weather patterns. And so I'm very concerned about the fire situation, and I'm very concerned about the beetle brood that's going to develop towards the end of summer out there. So I don't know if I had answered all your questions or not.
Does that help you, sir?
Oh. Well, yeah, I mean, but in terms of this climate debate, you know, that goes on nationwide with people are saying that, you know, man has affected, I don't know the guy's first name is Lundberg, ring a bell. Who predicts climate? And you've written some pretty extensive stuff. So
yeah, no. there are many.
Thanks for the call.
Many models, over 100 climate models, and a lot of times you'll see the weather forecasters refer to the European model and the American model with regard to hurricanes and things like that. You know, this is a complex topic. So yeah, climate change is real, but climate change has always been real. It's always our climate fluctuates. It goes through cycles. There's plenty of evidence that humans have had an impact on our climate, but the magnitude of that impact is a debatable thing because we have other things, you know, solar radiation, cosmic radiation, Volcanoes. You know, years ago, I mentioned the Tonga volcano, and there are more studies that have come out now, and that's had a huge impact on our overall climate. And even that's still being debated. So, I mean, I'm not going to downplay the effect that humans may have, but my point is there's still so many unknowns in this incredibly complex phenomenon that we have to try and do better with what we do, but we also have to realize that nature provides us with quite a few fluctuations.
Human beings are a part of the mix, that's for sure. So we're gonna come right back. We have another hour, by the way, of Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin, and those of you on hold, we appreciate it. We'll get you.
This is TalkBack, 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309.
This is News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. KGVO, Missoula's news and weather station.
Welcome back, everybody. Hour number two of TalkBack for this last day of March is brought to you this morning by Quality Seamless Gutters of Montana. Expert gutter installation and repair. Call Quality Seamless Gutters at 728-4002 and get a free quote. Bruckner's Truck and Equipment. Heavy-duty truck sales, parts, and service. Call Bruckner's at 541-9097. Why West Storage. Secure flexible self-storage in Missoula. To reserve your unit today, call Why West at 510-0590. Busy Bee's Cleaning Service offers commercial cleaning you can trust. Call 550-3219 and get a free estimate. Pivots Plus is Montana's leader in irrigation parts service and sales. Call Pivots Plus, 683-4418. Gomer's Diesel, diesel repair parts and service in Missoula. Their number, call 728-7620 for Gomer's. And by Harrington Surgical Supply, where they provide medical and surgical supplies to healthcare professionals all across Western Montana. Call Harrington at 721-8468.
The views and opinions expressed on TalkBack are not those of the staff, management, or advertisers.
Okay, we are back on TalkBack. 721-1290 is our number. If you just joined us, Dr. Peter Kolb, forestry specialist, and Sandy Perrin, plant clinic coordinator, both joining us here in the studio. We've already spent a full hour. You guys aren't tired yet, I hope. We've got more folks waiting on the line. Lisa, thanks for your patience and waiting through the break. Go ahead, please.
Well, good morning, everybody. Excuse me. I would probably better direct this question to Sandy. I have a bunch of Easter lilies, or not Easter lilies. I think they call them daffodils. We call them Easter bells in German, and Peter would know which flower I'm talking about. Anyhow, they were here when I moved into this house. And every year I had a lovely bunch of these flowers at around Easter time. And one year I had 14 of them, and I even cut a couple of them down and brought them into the house. And after that, I noticed I had a lot of new green growth, but the flower production was down. And this year, even though I have a beautiful stand of the green leaves, I have only two yellow big lilies on there. And I wonder what could be the cause of it. And I wonder if it would be a good time to dig them up and at what time to dig them up so I can find a different spot for them.
Yeah, so with most bulbs, daffodils, Easter bells, they do propagate down there, so they start sending out little bulblets, and so then the hole gets pretty crowded and nobody gets enough nutrition. So a good time is once the foliage dies back, because that's what charges the bulb for the next season. So either probably in another couple months, or if you can remember that spot in the fall, either or, whenever it works for you, sometime in the summer, to dig that up and separate those bulbs, give them some good, probably bone meal in the hole when you replant them.
Yeah.
And they'll, you know, may take a year or two before they rebound, but definitely they will rebound.
Okay. Well, that's good advice. And I want to say this whole program is very informative for everybody. Everybody has some problems in their garden or wherever, and we all learn from that. And thank you. Goodbye.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Thanks for the good words. Dave is standing by. Dave, good morning. You're on TalkBack with Dr. Kolb and Sandy.
Yes, I'm not sure you talked about this subject earlier, but fertilizer markets. From what I've been told, the war in Ukraine, Iran, has caused a shortage of fertilizer for farmers. And I'm curious if it's already happened, causing price increases, and would that impact the quality of crops and the quantity of food and the price of food? Would you like to talk to the subject?
Everything is connected, right?
Sure. There's actually a program on that, news program on that just this last day. And so mainly what we're talking about is nitrogen. And the reason all the fertilizer plants are in oil-rich countries is because to take N2 and out of the atmosphere and turn it into NO3 is a very, very energy-intensive process. And so, yes, because of that, nitrogen fertilizer prices have spiked quite a bit. And the concern is, in modern agriculture, it is a very fertilizer-intensive process. I mean, so a statistic given for Montana is every acre is producing about 4 bushels of grain, which is, that acre is requiring 100 pounds or more of nitrogen. And when nitrogen is all of a sudden costing $4 a pound or more, then your cost of fertilizer is more than the cost of your finished grain product, which has been exacerbated by the tariff issue, where in retribution, of course, Montana is a net grain exporter. And so if we're not going to import widgets from China, they're not going to buy our grain. And so we now have a grain surplus and grain prices have tanked a bit. So, you know, Clayton Jones from Montana State University did a really nice news segment on that just this last yesterday, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's going to impact a whole lot of things. And, you know, high-tech agriculture is great. Just to comment on that, I mean, within Extension, we've been pushed and pushed and pushed for the last 50 years to help farmers increase productivity. Well, we can do that, but it requires more inputs. So you got to farm more land, you got to add more fertilizer. Farming more land means more high-tech equipment, so your capital outlay is way higher. So it's a difficult scenario to do the productivity, because the United States is part of feeding the rest of the world that can't feed itself. And Ukraine is the other, we've talked about this in past sessions, Ukraine is the second largest deposit of what are called mollisols. Those are the really thick, dark soils. And their production has tanked because of the ongoing war there. So, you know, there's all sorts of things going on there that are affecting these things. And people want to point their finger at just one, but it's multiple factors that are playing into this. So we can expect, I mean, farmers and ranchers are hurting in Montana because they rely on that export market, and they've lost a lot of that. So, you know, flip side is that other manufacturing in the United States has gained a lot, because we're not importing stuff that is being manufactured elsewhere, because their labor and their environmental standards and costs are so much lower. So it's a pretty tricky balancing act.
And it is happening right now, I take it. It's not sometime in the future.
Well, again, a lot is going to depend on oil supplies and whether or not the manufacturing in those oil-rich companies can come back up. I mean, I just read an article this morning that we're going to face a severe aluminum shortage because, again, aluminum production is a energy-intensive process. So, I mean, we used to have an aluminum plant up in Columbia Falls, and that shut down because internationally it was not competitive. And all that, a big chunk of that went to the Middle East because they have more energy than they know what to do with. So they built manufacturing plants there, and that's all been shut down now because of that. So the sooner that the Middle Eastern and those oil exporting countries are back online, the better for us. And we can get into the political implications of what's going on over there. But that's, even though I have opinions, that's outside my expertise wheelhouse. So I won't talk about that.
Okay. Dave, thanks for the call. We're going to come right back. We have Harry waiting to visit with you. And we have all our other phone lines open. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Kolb or Sandy Perrin, they are here until 10. So get on the phone and give us a call. 721-1290. We'll be right back.
Cold and flu. Dennis Bragg with your updated weather. A chance of mixed rain and snow showers again on Tuesday, but just a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. After that, look for some sun breaks with a high near 53 degrees and calm winds. Then on Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 32 and again, light calm winds. For Wednesday, clouds will hang around with a 40% chance of rain mainly afternoon. Highs just below 60 degrees. And on Thursday, looks like we'll be back to some rain showers across west central Montana.
Phone lines are filling up again as we continue with Dr. Peter Kolb, forestry specialist with MSU Extension Forestry. Sandy Perrin is the plant clinic coordinator here for Missoula County. And let's jump right back in and get Harry's calls. I'm waiting the longest. Harry, thank you for holding. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, good morning, folks. Yeah, I have a currant bush, and it's just decorative currant, but it blooms beautiful. I mean, you know, in the spring and summer, but then it wilts. I know it's a fungal. I'm wondering, what is the best time to treat that fungal? You know, how early should I treat it? And also, talk about fertilizer. When is the best time to fertilize the lawn?
Typically, if we're fertilizing for the lawn situation, I have taken MSU's stance of fertilizing the holidays. So typically, you're fertilizing right before Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Halloween. If you want to add an extra one in, you could either do probably sometime here shortly, I'm going to say, probably in another couple weeks, just depending on how much you want to mow and what, how much your soil absorbs and so forth, how much you want to spend on it. Okay. On the currant bush, I don't know what you're referring to, so I'd have to see a sample to know what disease you're referring to on that. Dieback doesn't sounds fungal, but until I would actually know to, you know, typically whether it's, you know, spray a fungicide before it happens, but
now can you take a photo and email it to you or what?
Sometimes that works.
Okay.
Just all depends on, you know, how common it is.
So Sandy,
go ahead.
So one thing is, you know, to also get a soil test from underneath your currant bush. And because a common antifungal agent without actually having to use a fungicide is lime. So to increase the alkalinity, fungi does not like alkaline situations. So just a lime powder or lime sprayed on your bush can knock back a fungi on trees as well quite a bit. It'll discolor it a little bit because it leaves a white residue on there. But if your soil is excessively acid, then the lime would also help because those leaves are going to drop off and the fungus stays active in those leaves. So adding a kind of a lime spray on the bush and on the detritus underneath that could solve some of the fungal issues.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, sir. We appreciate it. And that means Catherine is standing by. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning. I have kind of an informational question here. What is regenerative agriculture and how is it different from current farming practices? And does regenerative practices increase or decrease the amount of food available for people? Is it something that should be practiced or is it only something that smaller farmers and ranchers should do?
So regenerative agriculture usually refers to soil building. You know, traditional high production, say wheat production, for example, tends to deplete soils. It tends to deplete the organic matter in the soil. And the organic matter is important because it holds on to the nutrients really well. It tends to be a little bit alkaline in nature, or it'll vary quite a bit. But the organic matter, think of it as a sponge that holds on to the good things. And without it, rain, which is slightly acidic, will leach soils. High yield crops like wheat deplete the soils because all the nutrients are going into the seed head, which is being removed off of that. So the notion of regenerative agriculture is to rotate crops and bring in crops, and some of them, which are grown simply to be plowed in the soil, to rejuvenate or add to that organic matter in the soil and its ability to hold on to the necessary nutrients. So as a concept, it's a great thing. It should be done. The problem is that, you know, if you have a landscape and you're expecting X number of bushels off that landscape, regenerative agriculture reduces the crop yield. Because again, it's what you're taking off of that soil. If it's just all, you know, based on your finished product, You're taking a lot of out of that soil by removing the crop that you're harvesting. And so when you have a crop, a plant species that is rebuilding that soil structure and soil organic matter, the cost is you're not going to get as high a yield off of it for the grains that you want. But, you know, rotating between legumes, which are nitrogen fixers, and grain crops, which are nitrogen users, is one of those real basic things. Again, the problem is the climate. Legumes are harder to grow in places, so the climate may not be conducive for those alternating crops. And again, the cost is almost always less yield per acre. Sandy?
So, does that also include not using commercial products to impact the soil too?
I'm not aware that there are any standard specifics, like the label organic requires certain things, no pesticides, etc. I'm not aware of any specific standards with regard to regenerative agriculture. It's the basic principle is doing what you can do to restore, rebuild, add to soil characteristics that are desirable, which is organic matter, water holding capacity, cation exchange capacity, things like that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. With that, we're up against a break. We have Ed and Bev both standing by to visit with you. Again, Dr. Peter Kolb and Sandy Perrin joining us here this morning. They'll be here till 10 o'clock, here waiting to take your phone calls about your garden, your yard, forestry, whatever it might be, nature, you name it. 721-1290 is our number. We'll be right back.
Montana State News Network.
I'm Dennis Bragg. A real strong response to the offer of getting property tax rebates. Governor Greg Gianforte and the Montana Department of Revenue announcing yesterday owners of over 250,000 primary homes and nearly 36,000 long-term rentals are now enrolled in either the homestead or long-term rental reduced rate programs. Tracy Taylor reporting some disturbing new numbers on Montana's suicide rate.
According to new data from the Violence Policy Center using figures from the CDC, Montana now has the second highest suicide rate in the nation. The state reported a rate of 26.7 deaths per 100,000 people in 2023, up from third place in 2020. Health officials say factors like rural isolation and limited access to care can contribute to higher rates. If you or someone you know needs help, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available by calling or texting 988. Tracy Taylor, Montana State News Network.
A young male will face charges in Missoula after he attempted to strangle a member of his household, leading to a standoff that lasted for several hours. Missoula police called to the city south side Monday afternoon to the report of the disturbance, but say the youth refused to come outside. The crisis negotiation team responded with officers using drones to keep an eye on the house. Eventually, they obtained a warrant and were able to subdue the suspect and enter the house after deploying chemical agents, forcing the youth outside where he was arrested. No one was injured in the standoff. Senator Dane says the war in Iran is going better than reported in most of the media coverage, but he remains supportive of the efforts launched by the Trump administration to force a regime change.
This is one of the greatest threats we have in the world. We've seen just recently when they launched that ballistic missile that got all the way to Diego Garcia that went nearly 4,000 kilometers. That's about 2,500 miles. They've got capabilities to hit London from Iran. And they were literally just short period away from breaking out with a nuclear weapon.
This is the Montana State News Network.
When faced with complex challenges, there are people who come together to solve problems and transform lives. That's us. We are Rotary. We work with community partners to build green spaces for all to connect with nature and each other. We support local youth through mentorship and literacy programs. We're committed to causes that improve lives everywhere. Learn more at rotary.org/action.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country this spring. More than just a walk, Moving Day is a fun experience that unites the community in the fight against Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's doesn't stop, and neither will we. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register for an event in your area at movingdaywalk.org. That's movingdaywalk.org.
Hey, welcome back to Talk Back. It's hour number two of Talk Back with Dr. Peter Kolb and Sandy Perrin. And let's continue on. Folks have been waiting. Ed, thanks for holding. You're on Talk Back. Go ahead, please.
sure enough, I guess every couple of years I ask this question, and that's, what's happening with the poplar tree project at the sewage plant? 90,000, according to a website, a city website, 90,000 poplar trees were planted, several years ago. Is there any market for these trees, and what is the plan for them?
Okay, so the quick answer is there is no market for those trees. Okay, it's they're fast growing. They grew tall. The main purpose for that plantation was a bioremediation, because once everything goes through the sewage treatment plant, the liquid that comes out—I don't want to necessarily call it water.
Isn't it called effluent?
Well, or something. Well, like that. Effluent can be lots of. But right. Okay, the final product will either go into the Clark Fork River, and just to be clear, you're not supposed to be anywhere within 20 feet of what comes out of that sewage treatment plant. So it's not, drinking water, if you will. So the poplar plantation was great because that was irrigated by this high nutrient loaded water-like material, and the poplars then would evaporate that water, and there was some bioremediation that was going on in the soils, and a lot of the metals and things that are still in that water got tied up there. So that was a primary purpose for the poplar plantation. The secondary purpose was to come up with a wood product out of it, but poplar was not the best species. It's got kind of crappy form, so not really nice straight logs or anything like that. So everybody's looked long and hard to find a market for it and haven't found it. Now, some testing has been done. So based on discussions, one of the recommendations was to grind this stuff up because poplar doesn't have many defense chemicals in it, so it decomposes very quickly. And so they've done some trials, and this is part of discussions that I was involved with as well. So I believe they did 5 acres where they ground it up and kind of added to the soil, and I estimate it would take 3 years for it to break down. It actually has broken down even faster than that. So I think the plan is, to be cost effective, is to slowly grind these up, add them to the soil as a mulch, let it break down, because raw wood chips actually deplete the soil until they're decomposed, okay? Because the fungi that break it down need the nutrients that are in the soil. But once it's broken down, and the soil down there is horrible, it's a rock field. So once that's broken down and you have a better soil, then to go to more of a crop, alfalfa has been thrown out there, something like that. And so they want to maintain the ability to bioremediate water that's coming. Did I say water? Okay, liquid that's coming out of the sewage treatment plant. At the same time, the alfalfa that comes up there is perfectly safe for livestock to eat. And so I think that is kind of the long-term plan. The trick is to do it in a cost-effective manner for Missoula taxpayers. So I hope that answers your question.
Okay, so no plans yet.
No, they're working on it. I mean, like I said, there's a lot of trees there, and it's a significant acreage, so you don't want to buy into one practice that's going to cost X amount of dollars and have it not work on you. So that's why they did a 5-acre test plot on it, and I think it's worked out extremely well. But, cutting and grinding up those trees is expensive. So you got to find a way to pay for it, whether we can pay through a carbon sequestration market. So, it's a work in progress. They're going about it in a thoughtful manner because, you could deal with it this year, but it's going to cost the city taxpayers $1 million to deal with it. And so how not to put that tax burden on people and try to find a way to get it to pay for itself. And
well, that'll be spread out over a period of time then, right?
Right.
It's still going to cost millions.
But it's still working. I mean, so they are still pumping liquid onto that poplar farm. The trees are transpiring, a million gallons of water into the air, which, is then clean water. The things you don't want are being absorbed or being worked on by the soil microbes. So it is still working. The concern was because these hybrid poplars are clonal organisms, that you get a disease or an insect in there, it's going to wipe it out in 1 year. It's not a stable.
How do they protect it? Or can they?
You don't want to. I mean, you could use insecticides and fungicides, but you don't want to. So they're trying to work as trees die. They take them down, they grind them up. So you know, it's going to be a gradual process, but it's going to be much more cost effective as a gradual process than just saying, hey, I'm going to do this right now. I mean, ideally, someone want to say, yeah, I'll offer the city $1 million for these stems. The problem is you've grown really poor wood fiber. It makes poor paper. And you might recall way back when some brainchild out of Boardman, Oregon, planted thousands of acres of hybrid poplars, and they were going to fuel a power plant with them and all of that. But again, they didn't quite do their homework. That poplar wood is very low BTU value. The expense of harvesting and processing did not pay for itself because the energy you got out of them didn't pay back the cost of growing them. And so that whole project was abandoned. And this was thousands and thousands of acres. Luckily, Missoula, it's only 90 acres with this issue on it. And again, it's a good group of people. I've worked with them, and they're trying to be thoughtful and cost effective. And I think they're on a pathway. We found a solution to slowly convert this, to improve the soil, sequester some carbon, and eventually turn it into a crop production system where we can still find a way, rather than dumping this water in the Clark Fork, it's going to go into a bioremediation process, which is that 90 acres that's going to grow crops that can utilize all that nitrogen that's in that water.
I remember driving along the interstate around Boardman, seeing those poplar trees. It was amazing. I mean, and they just walked away from them, right?
It was somebody's massive bankruptcy write-off. It was, again, great idea, not thought out real well.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'll bring it up in a couple years.
Okay, well, hopefully we can give you some results that the city is now making money selling alfalfa.
Well, we're going to come right back. We have Bev and Jeff both standing by. 721-1290 is our number. Several other phone lines open. We have another 28 minutes or so to get advice from Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin. So take advantage of it. They're going to be here for just a few more minutes. We'll be right back after this.
With KGRZ Sports, here's your sports update. Brought to you by Campbell Kia of Missoula. New and pre-owned vehicles at a no-pressure buying experience. Located off Expressway and online at CampbellKia.com. Here's a sour one.
Grizz men's basketball star Money Williams has officially announced he has entered the transfer portal. Via Instagram, he said, "I want to thank Grizz Nation for all the love and support they've given me from day one. It will never be forgotten. Grizz Nation will always hold a special place in my heart. That said, I have decided to enter my name into the transfer portal to explore my options." Money played 3 seasons with the Grizzlies, 81 games, and he racked up over 1,300 points, including almost 700 this last season, one of the highest scoring single seasons in Grizz men's basketball history. A pair of Grizzly softball players were honored by the Big Sky Conference this week. Grace Lopez was named Big Sky Player of the Week, the first for a Grizzly since 2024. Kara Sweet was the Pitcher of the Week. That's a look at sports. I'm A. Sauerwald.
Hey, welcome back to Talk Back, and we continue now with great advice from Dr. Peter Kolb and Sandy Perrin, and Bev is standing by. Bev, good morning.
Morning. Thank you for the opportunity to ask my question. My question is about my lawn, the mild winter. I have moss just taken off like crazy, and when I've looked at in the market, the only thing I can find to fight it is bad for dogs, and I have a dog. Is there something I can use that I can control that stuff?
Well, a lot of moss does go away once it gets hot and dry. The things you can do to alleviate it without using any products would be to aerate your lawn, which helps the soil compaction part of it, which is part of moss growing. Also, probably a deep thatching or raking the moss out of it. And reseeding, fertilization, all of that will definitely help.
Okay. I did aerate last year, and I reseeded with it was a combination of topsoil and manure, and consequently, they just get in there and rake it all and try to reseed again then, huh?
Yep. Aeration, okay. Though, aeration yearly is not a bad thing in most of our soils.
Okay, thanks so much.
Quick question for you. What is top dressing? Because I see that advertised all over the place. What is it?
So it's usually a type of a product that has a little bit of nutrition, like a finished compost. Maybe it has some manure in it, too. And that just a light layer somewhere around a half an inch It'll help hold in moisture and add a light nutrient base.
And there are some companies that actually do that. They just do top dressing.
They certainly do. Right. Yeah, there's several companies that go around town that have that certain equipment that they can put that light layer on, and it makes a world of difference.
Great. Wonderful. All right. This is Jeff. Jeff, thanks for holding. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Let me try to stand up here real quick. Earlier caller prompted a question in my mind. I've been reading a guy who on Substack who I thought was initially pretty reasonable, but lately he's kind of seems to be more and more fringe. And he had a recent post that talked about how commercial farming is destroying the land because all it's doing is dumping NPK, he called it, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium into the soil along with glyphosate, and that's all just going to poison everything, and we're not going to have any soil anymore. And so the comment on regenerative farming made me ask, is he just kind of the guy on the street corner shouting the end is near, or is there something that we need to look out for? And I imagine farmers would do that because this is their livelihood, and they're not going to do stuff that knowingly damages their livelihood. So if either of you guys have any input into, you know, fertilizers, I know NPK is pretty much just the constituents of regular fertilizer in various forms, so concentrations. But what do you think about that sort of doomsaying?
Okay. Go ahead, Dr. Kolb.
Yeah. Well, I was going to give Sandy a chance because I already pontificated on this a little bit. You know, and interesting enough, this morning, Dr. Patrick Barkey's Economic Minute was very, very telling to this question because it all boils down to what you pay for things. And, you know, we complain about cost of things. But food is heavily, heavily subsidized in the United States, as it is in many countries. You know, we're trying to keep prices of food down for people because worldwide, a statistic is something like 60% of the world's population doesn't get enough to eat. Not in the United States, but, you know, and you know, we do have our poverty groups as well, not to downplay that. So as we're trying to feed the world, this is why we've gone to high-intensity, mass-production agriculture of one sense or another. And, you know, like beef production is a big part of Montana, but the average poor person can't afford beef. I mean, my wife and I haven't eaten beef for a while because it's too expensive for us to buy. So it's all what you're willing to pay for and what the cost of things are. So, you know, it's a great question that you're asking. And that the person you were referring to, it's worth being cognizant of that issue. And on the other side of it, it's everybody wants a crisis or a controversy and using that as a marketing tool as well, that the world is coming to an end. Global warming has fallen into that category as well. So, you know, the trick is, yes, we are a capitalistic system where money is the bottom dollar. And you can be negative about that, you know, but the positive side of it is it drives innovation. And if people are willing to pay for something, there will be a market developed for it. And when you have a free market society, then innovation occurs. Because if you come up with a better way of doing things, you can make more money doing it. And I think there is concern and there is awareness that purely farming a simple genome, a simple carbohydrate, and just fertilizing it every year with the three basic elements, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, that it's hard on the soil, and it's not nutritionally good for you. I mean, we have a carbohydrate addiction in the United States, and I'm guilty of that too, and have suffered some health consequences as a result of that. So usually markets will correct for things. But when you think that hunger remains a big issue, and most places in the world can't grow a good crop, not at a profitable level. I mean, people do a lot of subsistence farming in Africa, a lot of subsistence farming where you're basically growing your food supply for the year and there's not enough of it. You know, so that you got to think of all those types of things. And that's philosophically, I'm a supporter of organic farming. You know, it has its place. And we're just having a discussion here in the office. You know, the downside of organic farming is there's a lot of nasty biology things out there, you know, because, and I grow my own carrots, but if I can't grow them, I actually want the mass-produced carrots because they're clean and they're relatively sterile. Organic carrots have all sorts of stuff stuck to them, you know, whether it's pig poo or whatever. And, you know, there's a lot of parasites and things like that. And so, you know, there's trade-offs to all these things. And luckily, again, I'm going to harp on the free market system. Free market system allows for innovation to correct those things. Whereas if it's a government-controlled system, the innovation goes away. It only occurs if the government approves on it and somebody with a rubber stamp thinks, oh, yeah, I'll go along with that. So, you know, give it time, but you vote with your wallet. So if you want to change the system, be willing to pay a little bit more for things that are produced in a way that you feel is sustainable. So sorry for that kind of esoteric philosophy.
Well, do you think it's doing long-term damage, or do farmers do things to mitigate it? I understand it's very simple, and soil depletion, minerals, and different things.
Well, excuse me. I work with a lot of farmers because I do a lot of windbreak and shelter belt work across Montana. And I would say the majority of the farmers I work with are deeply concerned about their soil. They're deeply concerned about their crops. But
because that's their livelihood.
Right. But they have to make a profit. You know, if they can't pay off their equipment, they go bankrupt and someone else buys it. And so I'm also a supporter of family farms. Excuse me. You know, when all these come into corporate farms, then the bottom line is profit. You want a 20% return type of thing. And this is the same thing in the timber industry. You know, when it's family-owned forestry, it's a lot closer to nature. It's a lot more sustainable. If you're growing trees like corn, then exactly the same thing. You harvest, you clear cut, you fertilize, you herbicide, you plant fast-growing trees, and 20 years later, you do that again, and that allows people to have cheap 2x4s and more affordable housing. Whereas, you know, someone who is managing for wildlife habitat and water quality and all those things isn't going to have the fiber production that someone else has. So, you know, this is part of the great capitalistic experiment in the United States. And so far, there isn't, in my opinion, there isn't a better system that shows adaptation and ability to. And so, yes, there are farms that are not doing it sustainably, you know, and you look at why, just like there are companies that are not sustainably managing their forests. And that's because they're teetering at the brink of bankruptcy and they're just trying to stay alive. And that's a reality of it. It doesn't mean they're bad people. They're just trying to stay alive. And we try to help them so that they can do it in a more sustainable manner.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. We're up against a break. And by the way, all of our phone lines are free now. So if you have a question for Dr. Kolb or for Sandy Perrin, she's the plant clinic coordinator. Dr. Kolb is forestry specialist with MSU Extension Forestry. And so they're here to answer your questions for another 18 minutes. So we're going to come right back after this.
Business owners.
Life. It's full of moments, from first steps to first loves, moments that make life special. A life can also bring us difficult and disruptive moments like a cancer diagnosis, which is why the groundbreaking work of Stand Up to Cancer is so vital. They know the problem of cancer won't be solved by one doctor, one lab, or one hospital. It takes collaboration. That's why Stand Up to Cancer brings together top minds from different fields to find new and better treatments so patients can thrive. So when it matters, we can all show up for moments of a lifetime. Please join Stand Up to Cancer and Myrtle Beach to help families get back to where they belong, making new memories for years to come. Please go to standuptocancer.org to see how you can join the mission.
Welcome back, everybody. In the last segments now of our time together with Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin. And let's see, Rob is on the line. Rob, good morning, sir. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead, please.
Hey, good morning, everybody. So I have a lawn care and light landscaping business here in Missoula. And what I recommend for, and I'm asking as a question if this is the best way to go, is I sort of recommend to clients that they just get on a three-year cycle. 1 year we do dethatch. 1 year we do an aeration. And then we do a little top dress overseed with compost over from eco compost.
Yeah, that's fine. you know, there's all kinds of differences out there as far as soils, you know, how much topsoil you have. You know, there could be some certain variables in that. Just depends on right. your under, you know, what your base is. But that sounds pretty reasonable.
Now, Rob, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Plus, sorry, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
But my question was, do you when you get to a new client, do you test the soil? How do you go about doing that?
We don't do any soil sample tests, and you just gave me an idea to start offering that, and that would help make us more efficient and have more success with new plantings. We don't do that, but that's a really... great point.
No extra charge.
Extra charge. And I will say we focus on electric lawn care, which is pretty cool nowadays, especially with gas going to $1 million.
Definitely. A lot quieter.
Yep, it is a lot. That's what people really love is the quiet.
Is there anything else you'd like to ask Pete, Dr. Kolb, or Sandy?
No, we're just chilling.
All right.
I want to say the name of my business, but I'm not going to do that with you guys. It seems a little low.
You take care. Have a great day. Let's get Patrick on the line next. Patrick, good morning. You're on Talkback with our guests. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Dr. Kolb. This is Patrick Brown, and I really appreciate your comments that you've been giving on what farmers need and so forth. And you and I have had some really great discussions on biochar and the influences that it can do to reverse some of the problems of the soils in the not only in the state of Montana, but the global problems that we have.
Yeah. So you want to talk about biochar?
You know me, I love to talk about biochar.
Well, for our listeners, so, you know, we have a fuels problem in our forest, you know, and naturally trees will regenerate based on spring characteristics and seed crop. So when we have a cool, wet spring and a good cone crop and lots of seeds, we will get conifer regeneration from hell. I mean, it makes knapweed look like a benign thing out there. And those trees, you'll get 10 stems per square foot. And yeah, you've all, if you've been hiking, you run into that. And it's very episodic. It depends on our weather, if you will, and the physiological cycles of trees. So historically, those would stagnate, and we'd have a dry summer, and those promote really hot fires, and you'd have a big black patch on the landscape, and sometimes that landscape was 1 million acres with a black patch on it. That's the history of our forests there. So to try and moderate that, because now we have human infrastructure in these landscapes, and we have lots of people calling for a return of wildfire, which... yeah, fire plays a role, but managing it is tough. It's a science, and it's expensive. So to deal with the fuel problem, one solution is to take this non-merchantable biomass, chip it up, and then basically dry distill it in a oxygen-deprived kiln, which produces charcoal, in essence. Okay, not what you buy as briquettes, but it's... wood that has been pyrolyzed under an oxygen-free environment. And the beauty of biochar, it has no nutrients in it, okay? It's like crystallized wood, if you will, is it's fairly negatively charged, so it holds onto those main nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, which are positively charged, and it also holds water real well. So the notion was that we take this unwanted fuel, we turn into biochar, and then we add it to soil, especially farms that have been heavily utilizing anhydrous ammonia, nitrogen source, which really acidifies the soil to the point where it won't grow crops anymore. And the biochar, which is negatively charged, can actually neutralize that acidity, increases water holding capacity, increase nutrient holding, you don't get leaching into the groundwater, all those things. The problem is that it takes for 100 pounds of woody raw material, you might end up with a pound of biochar.
Wow.
So it's an expensive process per pound of biochar, if you will. So how to fund that? You know, we have all of these carbon sequestration projects, et cetera. It'd be great that we could sell that as a carbon atmospheric CO2 remediation process. At the same time, we have all these subsidies to help rejuvenate these depleted soils. So you could tap into that. Then we also have fuel hazard reduction programs. So we tap into that, and you combine those threes, and all of a sudden you're kind of solving some of the world's problems by meeting the needs of three or four different entities. It's just nobody's put together the funding process for that, because it's going to require coordination between fuel hazard reduction, soil remediation, farming, et cetera, to move this relatively low-value product that is expensive to produce, and we just need buy-in to do it. So that's the whole biochar concept. Did I do that fairly?
Yes, you did. You outlined it very well, and we are working on producing a engineered biochar facility, but it has to be an engineered manufacturing facility. It cannot be offset biochar. Offset biochar does not have the same characteristics as being engineered, and so we've really been working hard to make that distinction, because the biochar, engineered biochar, allows even greater absorption of moisture, greater absorption of the nutrients, but it also now can be used in providing heavy metal collections around mining areas. It can help in a high altitude reseeding of mining areas. So there's a lot more that is taking place other than ag, but the ag is very important that we keep the soils healthy and growing the food that we require. But at the same time, we have the abilities now to basically clean the water before it hits a significant water resource.
Thank you for the call, sir. We appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break. Come back. We have Jerry and Andy both waiting to visit with us. And again, just a few precious minutes left with Dr. Kolb and Sandy Perrin. We'll be back after this 1 minute timeout. Have you ever been out? Hey, we are back on Talk Back. Let's jump right back to the phone. Say good morning to Jerry. Jerry, good morning. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Hi. My question is, I have three horse pastures kind of connected to each other, and in one of them I picked up some weed, and I think somebody told me it was called mullein weed. It's kind of a crawling with a round leaf on it, and it's pretty much decimated that one field, and now it's kind of creeping into my other two fields. And so I want to kill it off because, I mean, obviously the grass can't grow up through it at all. And the other problem is, though, is I don't know what to spray it with, because my wife at the same time has free-range chickens running all over there. So I don't want to, I don't want them eating it and then us eating the eggs. And so I was wondering if you knew what would be a good way to get rid of that.
First, you need to identify the plant. Yeah. It's not mullein,
no,
from what you're describing. So send a sample into Sandy.
Yeah, send me some pictures. You can text them to 406-550-1875.
Okay. All right, I'll do that.
Okay, thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. All right, I believe Andy is just standing by. Andy, go ahead, please. We've got about 4 minutes.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Sticking with the biochar, it's a wonderful additive. I'm wondering if we couldn't, there's a lot of schools that have the fuels for schools programs where they're burning wood. I was wondering about if we couldn't retrofit those burners to produce not only heat but biochar at the same time. It would be very advantageous, I think, if that would work.
I don't think it would work real well. So producing biochar is you're getting some heat out of it, but not a lot, because it's a, for lack of a better term, it's more of a cool burn. To make wood boilers cost effective is you want a hot fire that is producing steam, and what you get out of that is white ash. I mean, it's the wood has been reduced down to its basic elemental form. Biochar, your heat and your energy output is much, much, much less. It's lower temperatures, oxygen starved. A situation where basically you're yep, burning off the gases, the components of wood, but you're leaving the wood structure behind.
Right.
So I,
okay. Well, thank you.
You bet. No, it's a great idea. Ideally, naturally, without going through the technical aspects and forests, if dealing with this fuel, we burn, we create lots of small piles that burn a lot cooler, and they leave behind a charcoal bed. Whereas if we have huge machine-created piles, they burn really hot, and they leave behind an ash bed. So, you know, and a lot of land management agencies have adopted this tactic. So we're burning lots of small piles. It's a little more labor-intensive. But the thing is, you can burn piles when the weather is very conducive. It's raining. There's snow on the ground, usually in the fall. And each little burn pile leaves behind a charcoal component. And it's a lot safer than, say, doing a broadcast burn across the forest, which it, for many reasons, is much more difficult to do safely. So, you know, there's low-tech ways of doing it. There's high-tech ways of doing. And, I mean, I've been teaching classes to forest lenders on how to do lots of small burn piles for that same purpose. You're getting rid of the fuel, and you're actually improving the soil in the process.
All right. I want to say thank you to both of you for being with us today. Quick contact information from both of you.
Yeah, so you can get a hold of me at the office, either at 406-258-4213 or sparin@missoulacounty.us.
Dr. Kolb, quickly.
peter.kolb@umontana.edu. Email's the best. I don't do phone messages because it's a very inefficient way to communicate for me. Right.
Thank you both for being with us. We appreciate it. Thanks for all the calls. Nick, it's yours.
Yeah, so tomorrow's the start of a two-day kind of series we're going to do about the annual international conference with Myriad Kia, Bob Seidenschwartz, the Montana World Affairs Council. So tomorrow's show, from 8 to 9, we'll just start with Bob and Myriad. And then at 9, they're going to bring up Major Chris Corey from the Montana National Guard and perhaps one of the diplomats who's participating in the conference. And Thursday, we'll also have more special guests. But yeah, it'll be two days of shows just like that.
Oh, again, thank you to Dr. Kolb and Sandy. You guys are always such a treat. And thank you for taking all the calls and giving such great advice. We appreciate both of you. All right. Again, thanks to all of you for listening this morning. We appreciate thanks for all your calls because you're what generate the fun on this show. We appreciate each and every one of you as well. So till tomorrow, we wish you the best and please drive safely out there. And we will see you tomorrow morning bright and early at 8 o'clock for Talk.